Moms, this one's for you. A little girl was trying very hard to take care of her sick mother. She did everything to make her mom feel more comfortable in bed, and then she quietly slipped into the kitchen. She had seen her mother make hot tea for her father when he was sick, so she set out to do the same thing for her ailing mom. And so with cup and saucer in hand, the little girl took the tea into the bedroom, and her mother was so touched by her sweet act of compassion. The mother showered her daughter with praise and said, "I didn't know you could make tea." The little girl beamed with pride as she told her mom how she made it. She explained, "I boiled the water and tea leaves together just like you always do, Mom." The mother listened attentively while sipping the tea. The girl continued her story by stating, "But I couldn't find that little strainer thing, so I used the fly swatter." Her mom nearly spit out the tea as she exclaimed, "You used the fly swatter? Oh, but don't worry, Mommy. I used the old fly swatter so I wouldn't mess up the new one." Well, I'm sure, moms, you have stories like that, and maybe even more gross. And you might laugh about it now, but when it was happening, not so much. Being a mom is not easy, right? So it's appropriate to applaud and honor our mothers. And at the same time, I know that Mother's Day can be difficult for some of you for lots of different reasons. Perhaps your mother is no longer with you and you really miss her. Maybe you don't have a good relationship with your mother. Or maybe you'd love to be a mother, and that just hasn't happened. And so whether this is a painful day or a joyous one or a mix of emotions, I want to segue from moms to our study in the book of Joshua. Consider the emotions of dropping your toddler off at preschool for the first time, or when your child got on the school bus the first day of kindergarten. Or when you left your grown kid at college. Or maybe some other touching moments of release and letting go. Well, we're let in on a scene in Joshua that involved a spectrum of emotions. And as we'll see, like the tea served to the mom with the best of intentions, things aren't always as they seem. Well, turn with me to the book of Joshua, chapter 22. Joshua chapter 22, as we continue in our study in this book. And as we enter the last three chapters of the book of Joshua, this chapter 22, then 23 and 24, each chapter begins with Joshua gathering the people together for a speech that he's going to deliver. They are emotional words as he first addresses those who will be leaving and returning home to their families. It's a release and letting go kind of moment. He will then give a speech in chapter 24 that resembles his, in 23, that resembles his last will and testament. And then we will see at the end of our study in chapter 24, Joshua gathers the people together again for more of a formal covenant ceremony. It's a solemn time as these will be Joshua's last words to the people he loves, spent considerable time with, and is invested in. Well, in our passage this morning, Joshua chapter 22, there are many lessons for us. There's lessons on making snap judgments and a lesson on resolving conflict and handling confrontation, that things aren't always as they seem, and many others that I could mention here this morning. But as I read through Joshua chapter 22 in preparation for this morning, I looked for a singular thread that might tie all of this together for us. That's just kind of how my mind works. What is the thread that ties all of this together? And I believe I have a word that ties it together, and I believe it's the word passion. Passion. If we are to be strong and courageous, which is our theme for us as a church and from this book of the Bible, if we are to be strong and courageous, it's going to require passion. If we are to take that next step to where God wants us to be, passion will not only fuel that step, but it will sustain it for the long haul. The question on the table this morning, is, what are you passionate about? What are you passionate about? It has been said that one person with passion is better than 40 who are merely interested. Passion is all about a basic mindset and a heart attitude for embracing life with all that you have. It really answers the question, what drives you to do what you do? And what are you willing to go through for what you believe? That's what we see in Joshua 22. Passion drove them to do what they did. They're passionate enough about good things. And I want to pull out three good passions that we see right here that I believe ought to be our passions. There is here a passion for mission, a passion for purity, and lastly, a passion for unity. Passion for mission, passion for purity, a passion for unity. Well, look with me at Joshua 22. We're going to first see a passion for mission. A passion for mission. I pick it up in verse 1 of Joshua chapter 22. It says, "Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and said to them, 'You have done all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded.'" Joshua continues, verse 3. It says, "For a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission. Carried out the mission the Lord your God gave you. Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest as he promised, return to your homes in the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan, on the east side." Now listen, we've come full circle here. You recall, perhaps back in chapter 1, we saw Joshua give a charge to these same 2.5 tribes to participate with their fellow Jews in the conquest of Canaan and the land of promise on the west side, even though they already had land on the other side of the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan. And the backstory to these 2.5 tribes not having land with the other 9.5 tribes on the west side goes back to the time of Moses. Remember, Moses was going to abandon the land because the promised land was on the other side of the river, but the leaders of Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh had asked if they could stay in the land they had already conquered on the east side, because it was just what they needed for their flocks. The land was rich and fertile, and there were fine valleys for grazing large flocks. And in addition, the land had plenty of water, and it just seemed perfect. And Moses, reluctantly at first anyway, but he came along and he agreed that they could have that land east of the Jordan on one condition. The condition was, they had to cross the river with their fellow Jews on the west side and help conquer the land of promise, the land of Canaan. And then after that mission was completed, they would be allowed to return to their homes once again. And for what was likely a 7-year campaign, we can't tell exactly how many years it was, but close to like 7 years, these soldiers, as best as I understand it, they left their families on the other side of the Jordan River in order to conquer the land that they weren't even going to possess. Now, why would any soldier agree to this? Well, Joshua speaks to that at the end of verse 3. I already read it when he says, "You have not deserted your brothers, but you've carried out the mission, the Lord God gave you." Joshua connects it to a mission. They were passionate about a mission. But what is God called you to do? What is God asking of us as a church? You know, you've heard me say, and you're going to hear me say it quite a bit, that our mission as a church is making disciples. Making disciples. We are to be about only those things that connect to that mission. And it's when we rally around that mission as a church that we are called to, that it unifies our hearts. See, when we talk about mission, when we don't have a mission bigger than ourselves, we don't grow, we shrink. The Israelites were of one mind, one heart, because they kept their eyes on the same mission. And so these 2.5 tribes fought for a 7-year stretch with their brothers, because together they knew that was what God had called them to do. as a nation, subdue and conquer the land. That mission had been accomplished, and now Joshua gives them permission to return to their homes and their families. Now, it had to be a bittersweet time for them as they're heading back to their families, because on the one hand, I imagine the soldiers could probably barely wait to get home. Their kids have changed a lot in 7 years, and what did they miss? And they had many stories to tell of all the great things God had done. They couldn't wait to get back. But on the other hand, they'd be leaving the people they spent time with in the trenches around a mission and fought battles with them on the front lines. So Joshua gives this emotional speech that begins with his appreciation of their commitment to the mission. And he commends them for the great sacrifice they had made. Now, I believe this is more than just an aside, because Joshua here models a great approach to us. He commends them before he commands them. And it isn't this manipulative thing in which we commend someone to set them up for a zinger. You know, you ever done that? You know, I really appreciate you, but, you know, you're a really good teacher, but, and we come in with this dreadful but, this zinger. And that's not what he's doing here. You see, where there's obedience to God's mission, we should all be over that in affirmation. Church, appreciate your comrades. Appreciate those people who are on the same team. It's on this day we show our appreciation to moms, but we all know it should not be limited to one day. It's true within the church community. This ought to be a place where we get encouraged. I spoke to that in the epistle this past week. I mean, do you notice the servants who are faithfully doing God's work? Encourage them, affirm them. And when you're on the receiving end of that, doesn't it inspire you to continue in obedience? Well, Joshua commends them. Then he challenges them in verse 5 to be careful to continue in their love for the Lord, to walk in his ways, to obey his commands, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with everything they have. I mean, these are beautiful words from their general. And then Joshua blesses them, and he sends them away, and they head back to their homes, it tells us in verse 6. So they separate, 2.5 from the 9.5, they separate in shalom. They separate in peace. Is it going to stay that way? Will unity remain as in Israel as 2.5 tribes separate from the 9.5 tribes? And this is where this story gets real interesting. Look down with me at verse 9. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half-tribe of Manasseh, they left the Israelites at Shiloh and Canaan to return to Gilead, their own land, which they acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. We just went through that. See, so these 2.5 tribes are returning to the eastern side of the Jordan. And what is one of the first things they do? Verse 10 tells us, when they came to Gilalath, near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And we really ought to go, uh-oh. What are they doing building an altar? I mean, the dust had hardly settled, and they're building this altar on the river's edge. It might be on the east side, might be on the west, we're not sure, but it's definitely on the river's edge. I mean, and it's quite an altar. I mean, it speaks of it as an imposing altar. And this thing was enormous. You kind of go, what's going on here? Did you lose your passion for the mission? Are you abandoning Joshua's charge to be vigilant and keeping God's commandments and loving the Lord and walking in his ways and holding fast to God and serving him with your whole heart and all your soul? I mean, what is going on here? What are they doing building an altar? That's exactly what the other 9.5 tribes would like to know. They get word, and they aren't too happy about it. And that's an understatement. We come to a passion for purity. Passion for purity. Now, I find verse 11 quite interesting. Verse 11 says, and when the Israelites heard, note that, when the Israelites heard that they had built this altar on the border of Canaan. Now, they're going to react to that in a moment. We'll see it. But I want to focus on, and when the Israelites heard, the 9.5 tribes living in the promised land somehow hear about what these fellow Israelites did. Isn't it amazing how good news travels so slowly? But where there is some failure or bad news, it goes in one ear and out many mouths. It's amazing to me. When a racehorse owner named his horse Bad News, he was asked why that name. He replied, because bad news travels fast. Yeah. And all too often we live by the adage, you can't believe everything you hear, but you can repeat it. I mean, I ask, do you know the source of what's being said? Reminds me of a man who went to an estate sale, and he noticed that one of the items for sale was a large parrot. He had always wanted a talking bird, so when it comes up for bid, he offers $50. And somewhere else in the room, there's this bid for $100. And the bidding becomes hot and heavy, with someone always bidding $50 more than he, until the parrot is finally sold to him for $1,500. And when he goes to get the bird, he asks the auctioneer, can the bird talk? The auctioneer replied, who do you think was bidding against you? Be careful who we're listening to. Get to the source. Don't be content with a notorious group called they. These 9.5 tribes somehow hear about it. What do they do about it? Verse 12 tells us, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Based on what they heard, they're ready to fight. Now the question is, were they right or were they wrong to be ready for a fight here? Were the Israelites right in taking this issue on to the point of going to war with their former friends and fellow Israelites, or were they wrong? Now, my answer is a little of both. And if pressed further, I would say they were more right than they were wrong. But I want to look at the wrong aspect to it just for a moment here, because what was a slight misstep, I believe, and not right, were the assumptions made. Their response was on the basis of assumptions. You see, in the absence of information, we often fill it in with assumptions that may not be true. In the absence of information, we often fill it in with false assumptions. I mean, have you done that? And you're pretty convinced it's true. Oh, yeah, I know, yeah, I got it. Don't know all of it, but I know enough of it. This is what I know happened. You don't know. You don't. But you're pretty sure you do. Assumptions. Watch assumptions. A woman purchased a small bag of cookies from an airport vending machine, and she sat down with her cookies to wait for her flight, and she sat there and opened her book. A man sitting next to her suddenly reached down between the two seats and came away holding a cookie, and he put the cookie in his mouth and he ate it. She turned and glared at him, shocked that anyone would take one of her cookies. She reached into the bag of cookies and took one out, and she ate it, and the man looked at her. Then he reached back into that same bag and he took out another cookie and he ate it. She finally picked up the bag, she held it, and she took out one cookie and ate it, and then there was only one left. And the man reached over and took the last cookie. He broke it in half, gave her a half, and ate the remaining half. She walked away. She totally appalled at this man's behavior. She wondered how anyone could be so greedy and rude and not even seem to care. Still fuming, she headed to the ticket line to get on the plane, and she reached into her purse to pull out her ticket. And she was horrified to discover her bag of cookies was in her bag, unopened and untouched. She See, the truth of the matter was, she was the one eating his cookies rather than the other way around. Assumptions. We don't have all the information, we just think we do. And that's good enough for me. I'm running with it. How easy it is then for us to make rash judgments. We jump to conclusions, we make assumptions that are costly. That was their mistake in this incident. They jumped to the worst possible conclusion. Now, I want to give credit to where credit is due. Because this is not just some misunderstanding. This is a sign of health for the people of God. Because what we clearly see here, what's driving them to do what they do here, is a passion for purity. Purity of devotion and worship to God and to Him only. That's what's driving this. Now you say, why all the fuss over building an altar? Well, back in Deuteronomy chapter 12, you can check it out for yourself, but in Deuteronomy chapter 12, God spoke there in chapter 12 of Deuteronomy of the prescribed place where they were to offer sacrifice once they entered into the rest in the promised land. He was very specific. See, God carefully detailed what it was to look like when they settled in the land and where they were to worship. You couldn't just decide to put up an altar anywhere you wanted and worship there. No. God said it had to be here. That's the big deal over this altar. This was God's way of preserving the purity of worship. One altar, one faith, one people. Now, there's a lesson for us right here. The Israelites had such a passion for the true worship of God that they are stirred to act by any hint of unfaithfulness. The Israelites had such a passion for the true worship of God that they're stirred to act by any hint of unfaithfulness. Do we? And no doubt they were tired of fighting, but when it comes to loyalty to Yahweh God, they say, fight on. Because honor of God is worth fighting for. But we need to pause right here and ask ourselves this question and be honest about it. Is this what causes a fight in us? The honor of God. The glory of His name. I mean, is it really the honor of God and the concern for His name? Or is it about lesser matters of inconveniences and personal preferences? I mean, what are the matters we are willing to fight for? And are they the right battles? I read an article this past week that highlighted churches that are reaching millennials. It's a huge generation that we have to continually ask, how do we reach them? But in this article, it's highlighted churches that are reaching millennials. It gave several characteristics, but one of the characteristics of churches that are reaching millennials is that it's majoring on majors instead of fighting over minor issues. Listen, millennials are tired of it. They're tired of it. They're not going to go into a church where we're fighting over minor issues. They're not. We might have a tolerance for it. They're going, nuh-uh, why would I? It's not authentic. We got to take that seriously. See, majoring on majors instead of fighting over minor issues is not only reaching millennials, what God is all about. Are we passionate? Are we passionate about good things? Passion for mission, passion for purity. I really need to get this last one, passion for unity. Passion for unity. It has been said, the mark of community, true biblical unity, is not the absence of conflict, it's the presence of a reconciling spirit. Not the absence of conflict, that's inevitable, but it's the presence of a reconciling spirit. And what I believe we have here is that Israel models for us a pattern to follow when it comes to handling conflicts. And the Bible speaks of it in a lot of places. I'm just going to grab this one, but it lines up with other places. There are four steps that I want to give you that for resolving conflict that we can practice in our lives and in the church. First of all, number one, first step, investigate the problem. They investigate, they look into it. Cooler heads prevailed. It says in verse 13, look at, the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With him, They sent 10 of the chief men, one of each of the tribes of Israel, each the head of a family division among the Israelite clans. What are they doing here? They heard, they almost got all riled up to go to war with them, but they looked into it first. That's what they're doing here. They didn't just react. It wasn't this that we sometimes have, don't bother me with the facts because I already know what I believe attitude. Will we take the time to find and see if there just might be an explanation behind what we hear? Will we take the time to do that? Or we just want to jump with our conclusions, go, yeah, I got to figure it out. A mom was trying to get ketchup to come out of a ketchup bottle, right? Do you know what that's like? Well, during her struggle, the phone rang, so she asked her 4-year-old daughter to answer it. So she answered the phone, and she said, "It's the pastor, Mommy." And the mom said, "Well, you got to tell him I can't come to the phone right now." So she got to speak to the pastor on the other end of the phone. She said, "Mommy can't come to the phone right now. She's hitting the bottle." Now, for some of us, good enough for me. I have enough information. Might there be an explanation? Do we take the time? Might there be an explanation? Yeah, I know I heard it. Might there be an explanation? You sure you have the facts? See, a passion for unity should really slow us down to look into the situation before we go into fight mode. All right, so they investigated the problem. Secondly, they go to the offenders. Why is it we can talk to everyone else about it but the offender? Verse 15 tells us they went to Gilead. They went right to the source. Reuben, Gad, half-tribe of Manasseh, and they said to them, verse 16, the whole assembly of the Lord says, they're speaking on behalf of the whole assembly, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? See, once again, we see their passion for purity, don't we? Now, I need to point out again here, the nature of their concern was over the appearance of disloyalty to God. It wasn't just some matter of personal preference, but what seemed to be unfaithfulness to God. You see, their passion for purity was matched by their passion for unity. And they confront the matter by going to the offending party. They don't just talk about this problem with others or stir up more trouble in the community. They address the matter directly. And by doing so, they give an opportunity to hear an explanation. So they look into the problem. They go to the offenders. Thirdly, they clearly express their concerns. They don't bring up all kinds of stuff in the past. They stick to the subject. They speak of their concern that they've broken faith with God and they turned away from him. They go on to express how what they did might even affect them. I mean, they've been around this block before of one person's sin where it had far-reaching consequences, right? What would certainly be fresh in their minds is the whole thing of the sin of Achan and the impact it had on the whole community. I mean, he even says that. He mentioned it down in verse 20. When Achan, son of Zerah, acted unfaithfully regarding the devoted things, did not wrath come upon the whole community of Israel? He was not the only one who died for his sin. So they learned from that. They didn't want to repeat it. They didn't want to invite God's displeasure again. So they look into the problem. They investigate it, right? They go to the offenders. They clearly express their concerns. There's one more very important step here that gets dropped in the process of reconciliation and this whole idea of unity. Fourth step, they were willing to be part of the solution. They were willing to be part of the solution. We see it in verse 19. This isn't a stretch. They say, if the land you possess, they're saying to them, is defiled, listen, come over to the Lord's land, the promised land, land of Canaan, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and share the land with us. But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord our God. Do you see their heart in this? They're willing to even give up some of their own land if it would keep them from rebelling. Their generosity is noteworthy here. They didn't come at these offenders like bulls in china closets. Their desire was to win them over and avoid a major blow-up. You see, if our passion is for unity, Get this. If our passion is for unity, we will do whatever it takes to avoid war between the saints. There's no other way to say that. We'll do whatever it takes. I'll give you some of my land if I have to. I'd rather do that than have disunity right now. Wow. Now, let me share with you the flip side of this conflict to those being confronted. Because none of us like it when someone confronts us, right? This is how we're to respond when confronted. Now, again, Bible speaks to this a lot of other places. I'm limiting myself to Joshua 22 and look at their healthy response in verse 21. Verse 21. Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, The mighty one, God, the Lord, he knows. And let Israel know, if this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account. Do you see it here? They don't get defensive. They don't respond in pride. They don't walk away in a huff saying, oh, what do you know? They don't do any of that. See, their attitude is nothing to prove, nothing to lose. They take the accusation seriously. They agree that if this was the reason they built the altar, then this is sin. They should not be spared. See, they are in alignment with the truth. They weren't defensive, but they did give an explanation in the defense. Verse 24, they say, no, we didn't do it for what you think we did. We did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to us, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? And they further explain that this altar was not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. That's not what they set it up for. On the contrary, verse 27. No. It's to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow that we will worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. In other words, it is exactly the opposite of what you thought. The Israelites looked at the altar and at first thought the worst, didn't they? But they did not remain there. And catastrophe was averted because people did things the right way. And we need to applaud Israel in the handling of this matter, really. What the result? Look at how it ends, verse 33. They were glad to hear the report. They praised God. They talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites live. And we could have the half-tribe of Manasseh. And they even gave a name to the altar. It tells us in verse 34, it's called a witness between us that the Lord is God. And I get to that place, and I go, how many conflicts in the church end this way? With praise to God. Conflict ended with a clear evidence of God's presence, his peace, his truth on display, all because the people did things the right way, all because the conflict was handled properly, all because of their passion for unity. How strong is your passion for unity? And so instead of Israel fighting with each other, their peace was enhanced. Now listen, peace is not the same as a truce. General MacArthur said it this way. He said, a truce just says you don't shoot for a while. Peace comes when the truth is known, the issue is settled, and the parties embrace each other. And that's what happens here. Tucked away for us in Joshua chapter 22 are God-breathed words that are useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. Church, be passionate. Be passionate. Passionate for the right things. Passionate for mission. Passionate for purity. Passionate for unity. We witness here a strong passion for fidelity to God. We have witnessed here a deep loyalty and devotion to the true God. And when that is compromised, it is worth fighting for. But I appeal to you, church, be passionate for faithfulness to God. Be passionate for the things that really matter. Is what you're passionate about a high enough goal? Is what you're passionate about a high enough goal? Francis Johnson was a quiet man who spent his entire life in Meeker County, Minnesota. And for reasons that are lost to time, he began rolling a ball of twine in his basement in 1950. Francis rolled twine 4 hours a day, every single day. He eventually moved the ball of twine onto his front lawn and used railroad jacks to ensure proper wrapping. Johnson cared as much about the twine's roundness as its diameter. And what began in 1950 didn't stop until 1979. For 29 years, this magnificent sphere evolved at Johnson's farm, and he even had to eventually build a circular open air shed to protect it from the elements. And by that time, his ball of twine weighed almost 9 tons and was 12 feet wide. He eventually died of emphysema, and the town figured that likely it was because of 30 years of twine dust that killed him. But the people of that small town in Minnesota wanted to honor Johnson, so they somehow rolled this big ball of twine next to the water tower, and it's known as the world's largest twine ball rolled by one man. Now, what is it? What is it that would drive a man or a town to spend all of their spare time accumulating a ball of twine? Well, whatever else might be said about such a pursuit, we have to be impressed by the passion of those who focus their energies on one very precise goal. But I ask, is it a high enough, good enough goal? Larry Crabb put it this way. He said the core problem is not that we are too passionate about bad things, but that we are not passionate enough about good things. The core problem is not that we are too passionate about bad things, but that we are not passionate enough about good things. Church, are you passionate enough about good things? Things of eternal consequence. I mean, do you really want to get to the end of your life where it's all about some ball of twine? And that's it.